Not oh, now we're going to wait.
Okay, I thought you said he was here.
No, he was supposed to be coming right down.
Which is going a ways, but hey, it got me.
All right, public hearing, Senate Bill 130. Who's up? Who's the proponent? Somebody help me. Yes, sir. All right, what a guy.
Devin, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm here today on my own behalf. Senate Bill 130 comes to you from a pre-session filing via the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. And the essence of the bill is this. When the state takes an appeal from in the tax court, this allows for the private sector party, the individual citizen who has been affected by the decision, who won and who is subjected to a state appeal, to have the opportunity to receive attorney fees based on the judge's discretion on the appeal. Right now, the statute does not authorize the judge on the appeal to determine that, looking at this particular matter, that the taxpayer should be reimbursed, in effect, for the cost of, again, defending themselves when they've already won in front of the tax court. That's the essence of the bill. There are many other people that will be talking about what I'll call the statistical background, the data background. I'm here as a proponent in the interest of giving judges the power to do justice, not in every case, but whenever they feel that it's warranted in the facts of the case.
All right. Question, Senator Brady.
Chairman, thank you. Are you, from your comments, are you saying that if the private party appeals and wins, they would not be eligible for these recovery of costs?
The current statute, and this statute has to do with the state's appeal when it has already lost. So the state loses, it appeals, it loses again, this authorizes the award of attorney fees. I'm going to have to ask someone behind me who knows what happens if the taxpayer appeals and wins, whether or not the provisions call for the award of attorney fees. I don't know. And maybe counsel for the committee knows.
Counsel, enlighten us, will you?
Thank you, Chair. It looks to me that this would allow the court in its discretion to award attorney fees in any judgment in favor of the taxpayer in subsection 4A. That would be my reading of it.
If I may follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman.
Go ahead.
It does not talk about the state recovering fees from the taxpayer if the taxpayer appeals. And further answer still to the question from Senator Burdick, I don't know if there's a separate provision that does call for that.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
To follow up, once we get to the bottom of this, do you think it would be good policy to have the repayment only available in cases where the government files the appeal?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, I do, for this reason. We are talking about relative powers here. We are talking about government as policymaker and as taxmaker. That is, the government itself gets to establish taxation policy and taxation enforcement. If the government has already gone in front of the judiciary, taken a position, and lost, and the government chooses to appeal, this simply says the judge may at that time determine that it's fair to that taxpayer under those circumstances to allow the taxpayer to recover attorney fees. In a different situation, when a taxpayer loses and the taxpayer appeals, and this is assuming that the statutes don't allow for recovery by the state, and by the way, I think they probably don't, or else I would have heard about it. In those circumstances, you have, I'll say, the power and majesty of the government on the one hand and Joe or Jane citizen on the other, and in terms of the power, equities, and opportunities, I think the state can still afford to pay for its own costs of that appeal and its own attorney fees. The taxpayer is already having to incur his or her own attorney fees to challenge this decision, and usually for a taxpayer, that's a pretty big burden right there to take a case up and have to pay an attorney. So in terms of the relative financial powers involved, financial strengths, I think it's okay to make that distinction.
All right, any other questions? Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Larry Kaffenman. Help me if I pronounced or butchered your name or did something that offended you in some way. By the way, when Representative Shetterly comes into the room, we're gonna switch and take his testimony on another bill just to accommodate him. So if anybody sees him, let me know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries in support of Senate Bill 130. And with me today is Larry Tappanen, who will explain a little bit about the bill to you, and also Bob Olson from the Oregon State Bar.
Sorry.
Chairman Minnis, Chair Capivo. I represent Larry Tappanen, Tappanen Group. I'm in support of this bill. This bill will facilitate a broader use of the magistrate court that was established in Oregon a couple of legislative sessions ago. Within that magistrate court, there is a ability to come to mediation and to resolve things on a less cost situation. In order to get taxpayer and departments to coordinate this effort to use those facilities, we look to a means to allow some recovery if it ever got pushed higher than the magistrate court. And we found that under personal income tax litigation, the statute was already in place, that a person who was had a problem with their personal income tax and went through the same process, should they win, they would get their fees, possibly could get their fees paid if it was judged right. So in this case, all we have done is to substitute or amend that statute to include property tax. In this forum, a taxpayer would present their case through the magistrate court, through the mediation, on through. If they lost an appeal to tax court, official tax court, and won, they would get their fees. If they won in the magistrate court and or in that arena, and the state appealed that decision to tax court, and the taxpayer still prevailed in tax court, they would get their cost recovered. We found that the amount of litigation going on with personal income tax was minimal, and we felt that this was a form that was statute set up that works, and so we felt that doing it with the property tax would expand the thought that went into the original bill and make for a better forum for resolving conflict.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bob?
Mr. Chair, Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. I'm here mainly because the tax section and the administrative law section of the bar, they both support this proposal. And as Larry explained, this bill expands the concept of awarding prevailing fees to taxpayers, and that appeals to them, and they're supporting it. I think at this point it's probably good just to take any questions that anybody has about the bill.
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask the same question that I asked the previous witness, which is it your understanding that this bill would only award costs in cases where the government appeals, or would it apply if the taxpayer also appealed?
It's my understanding, Senator Burdick, that it would apply to both cases. If the taxpayer loses at the magistrate level and goes higher to tax court and wins, then he gets his they get their cost.
But I think Mr. Mannix agrees with what you're saying.
It doesn't distinguish between the two.
Doesn't distinguish between the two. It is an appeal to tax court.
Mr. Chairman, to
yes,
follow up, do you have any idea how many, you say this applies to income tax appeals now, how many more appeals would be involved here? In other words, if there are a lot more property tax disputes than there are income tax disputes?
Senator Burdick, I do not know. I do not have that information.
Thank you.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay, good. Betsy, do you have any additional testimony?
Mr. Chair, I did forget to say that Oregon Forest Industries Council asked me to express their support for Senate Bill 130 also, but they had a tax committee meeting today and couldn't be here.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Jim Craven?
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. We are in support of the bill. I don't have a whole lot more to add than that fact. We've worked with Mr. Tappanen over the years and with AOI on these issues, and we think this is a common sense approach. I think one thing that hasn't maybe been brought out, just to add to the debate and the record, is that this is at the discretion of the court. There's not an automatic awarding of costs. You don't just submit a bill and get paid for it. It is a discretionary action by the court. So, facts and circumstances will get weighed in these decisions, and it's not just a blank check for the taxpayer. So with that, I heard your support, and thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you. Question?
I just found the fiscal here. It says that the cost of $250,000 per biennium would be paid for from other funds. Do you happen to know, or council maybe is a better source of this, but where those other funds come from?
Chair, Senator Burdick, I don't know what the other funds are, but John Phillips is here from Revenue and could answer that question.
I will wait.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John Phillips, where are you? Does anybody have a simple answer to the question? A quick, simple answer.
John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I think the funds that would pay for this would just come straight out of the Department of Revenue's budget. So I don't know where the term other funds came from, but it would be our appropriation.
Is that the general fund?
The general fund.
Well, sometimes general fund becomes other fund when it passes through different places, so I don't know. Do we have somebody from legislative fiscal, maybe? Anybody down there in legislative fiscal is watching or listening, somebody who happens to have their budget, please call quickly. Jason Williams, we'll get your question answered, by the way. There's a guru down there that knows the answer.
I thought you were the guru.
Good afternoon, Chair Vinnis, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association here in Oregon. And I'll be very brief, but before I begin, I just wanted to give my commendations to the Tax Corps, because as I've had a chance to talk to a few people this week in preparation for this bill, every person who has gone through the Tax Corps always volunteered the information, oh yeah, and it was quick. And I just think that you usually don't hear that from a government process, and so they just kind of just want to recognize them in that regard. As you have heard, Senate Bill 130 would simply give the judge the discretion to award legal expenses for those taxpayers that have gone through the process. We think it's fair, also adds flexibility to the process. Taxpayers often find themselves in difficult situations where the attorney fees is more than the cost of what the disputed amount is. And so there's a lot of factors that go into when a taxpayer gets brought into the process, and we feel like this bill is just one of those small things that could help bring that fairness and flexibility to the system.
All right. So. Questions? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
I was going to comment, as I heard Mr. Wave's comment, the fact that it's rather rapid for government. I think oftentimes we're accused of ramrodding stuff through too fast, too, so we can't win either way, can we, sometimes?
That's true. Cindy Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm here representing Alaska Airlines. We're here supporting Senate Bill 130, although ideally it would be retroactive, because we're having a little bit of problem with the Department of Revenue, and we'd like to recoup some of the costs that we've already spent, but that won't happen. But we support this bill for the way it will benefit other people in our situation in the future. As most of you probably know, 44% of the flights coming out of PDX are Horizon or Alaska Air flights. In the smaller airports around the state, almost 100% of the commercial air flights are Horizon. So we do have a big presence. We've been in an argument with the Department of Revenue since 1991 over the valuation of our airplanes. What's being disputed is the value of some of the used planes. We contend that Oregon values those planes much higher than any of the other states. I believe there's 34 other states that do unitary tax like ours, and we believe that Oregon's is the highest. The outcome of all that is obviously not the newest technology planes flying into Oregon in order to help avoid some of the costs, and also a lot of documentation, a lot of subpoenas that we've had to answer from the Department of Justice, and a lot of time by some of our folks spent arguing about the valuation of these planes. We're bothered by it, and we hope this bill will help keep the department from doing such lawsuits in the future over the valuation and take a little bit more time to spend with the people outside of court to determine the valuation. I will add under that the Department of Revenue has been very good recently trying to come to some reasonable settlement with us outside of the lawyers. So we're very happy with the way things were going, but we'd be happy to see this bill pass and help other people in our situation in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Cindy, would you expound just a little bit on your statement? Are you saying Alaska Airlines does not send its newer, better planes into Oregon because of our laws?
They would contend that that is true, that it's difficult for them to, when they're deciding which planes go where, it's difficult for them to make the decision to send some of the newest technology planes to the Portland airport when the valuation of those planes is so high. They would make that argument, and I actually have some information I can provide you.
Safer to catch the plane in here?
All our
Seattle
planes are safe, sir. I'm just saying that some of our older planes are getting a better value as far as our taxation.
Well, I should
also add
Seattle to catch the plane.
I should also add, Senator, that we are not the only airline in Oregon having this problem.
Same
United
thing.
Airline actually recently dropped their legal proceedings against the Department of Revenue because of the merger that they're having with US Air. It just became too cumbersome. But we are not the only airline that feels like the state is heavily burdened tax-wise and shies away from and doing the most expensive planes there.
Would, Mr. Chair, just wonder if it would it be possible to get take an airplane and tell me what you would pay tax in California, and would you pay for that same one in Oregon? Would that
absolutely.
Get that
I can get that to you by tomorrow.
Love to see that.
I'll do that, Senator.
Thank you.
You're wondering whether I'm following this conversation.
No, I don't care.
It was extremely profound, too.
Thank you, Cindy. All right, who's next? Who's the next victim? Mark Nelson. How are you today, Mark?
All right.
Did we find a budget guru?
Aha.
No, there's a guru.
So you do watch TV, yeah.
Are you by chance the person who wrote this fiscal?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good, because you can explain it. Well, I think I know the answer. I'm going to wait and hear from you so I don't embarrass myself. Could you identify yourself for the record?
This is Judy James. I'm with Legislative Fiscal Office.
The question is other funds.
It's other funds because although this is largely a generally funded agency, when it gets into this program, it switches hands and becomes other funds instead of general funds in the budget.
All right. So it starts out as general funds, perhaps in terms of the appropriation limitation for the agency, but when it gets into the Department of Revenue, it becomes other funds.
So
that's what I thought originally. So thank
good.
You. Thank you very much.
You're
I appreciate
welcome.
That. All right, Mark, you're up.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Oregon Metals Industry Council. I won't prolong the hearing other than to say that we currently have in statute a process for income taxpayers on appeal, and you'll find that in as previous witnesses have indicated on lines 19, where we lay out on page 1 where under existing statute, if there is an appeal by a taxpayer to the tax court, judge, that in the discretion of the tax court, the judge can award a reasonable attorney fees and expenses. This just mirrors that process for real and personal property. The Metals Industry Council, as you might expect, has a lot of real and personal property that is taxed. There are times in which they do, in fact, have a disagreement with the Department of Revenue, which ends up in tax court. We believe it's what is fair on the income tax side is also fair on the real and personal property tax side, and would urge you to support the bill as it is written. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Anybody? Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. All right. Committee, where are we? Anybody care?
Mr. Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 130 amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so orders. Senator Duncan, would you please carry this?
Sure.
Would you rather someone else? That's fine. Thank you. Unless there are other volunteers.
No, I think you should get together though with the mother of the president of Alaska Airlines and settle this dispute about the lack of quality of airplanes.
Representative Shetterly, is he in the audience anywhere?
No.
Not. All right. It's between. Public hearing is going to go 163. Kevin Mannix, again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem, here on my own behalf. I'd like to start off by making a parenthetical remark, especially for the benefit of Senator Burdick, that I was wrong in that earlier answer that I gave you, and I did try to come up to Bob Olson and whisper, whoops, you know, I've just gone back and read this again, and I should have said any taxpayer appeal where the taxpayer prevails, and I'm glad they straightened it out, and I apologize for that. I thought for once I ought to be able to say I was wrong on the record.
We will note this date.
Senate Bill 163.
Before you get going, I want to just do something real quick. Close the public hearing. Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing him to vote on Senate Bill 130. Any objections? Hearing none. So
Courtney votes yes.
Courtney votes yes on Senate Bill 130. Done. Public hearing. Senate Bill 163.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Kevin, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 163 has two sections to it, and it really goes back to a policy issue about pursuits and what should be done to encourage having written policies for pursuits, this is police pursuits, in effect for the departments, and at the same time reducing litigation that may emanate from accidents that may occur when the person being pursued has an accident. The first part of the bill has to do with the existence of a policy and whether or not lawsuits can be brought when the person being pursued has an accident. The second part of the bill has to do with a directive to the state police to maintain a set of records on pursuits and to have local departments file reports with the state police so those records can be maintained. I will tell you that I've also distributed to the committee through council a marked-up version of Senate Bill 163, a preemptive amendment proposal, if you will, which changes the bill in two respects. First, it takes out the detailed description of what ought to be in the policies that various departments have, the reason being that I think it creates more problems than it solves, and departments have got written comprehensive policies about pursuits in place. Creating a legislative directive about that may cause problems in going back and reevaluating, seeing whether or not the particular mandates of the legislation have been met, rather than whether smart police practices and good public policy have been met for a given community. The second part of the changes focuses on removing the record creation part of the bill, that is, pulling together all of these reports. Initially, I had put this into the legislation with the idea that, well, we'll start keeping records on pursuits in a comprehensive fashion. But the reaction I've had is we're creating a lot of bureaucracy when there's not that many pursuits that do occur that require documentation. They're already documented at the local level. Wait till there's a problem before you propose a solution, is in effect what I was hearing on that. So I'm proposing that that part of the bill be removed. That's just a personal suggestion to the committee. We're back down to the tough policy issue, which is
what sort of liability do you have in place when pursuits occur? This bill, with the amendment or without it, would say if the department has a written policy in place, then basically its officers and the department cannot be sued as a result of things that happen in a pursuit due to the actions of a third party. That is, the person being pursued crashes into another car, runs into a building, hits somebody, that the liability ought to lie with the person who's being pursued, that officers who are determining whether or not they should engage in pursuit should be looking at good police practices, looking at the policy of the department, and not thinking in their minds, do I need to worry about being sued for going after this perpetrator? I'd rather have them focusing on what are the merits of the pursuit as to the perpetrator. Police will tell you that they already have severe restrictions in their pursuit policies because they understand the need to balance danger to the public from engaging in a pursuit against the desirability of apprehending wrongdoers, and that's a very tough call. I've participated in many hearings before the legislature, well, as a legislator, where we've been through this dialogue. I think at this point it's time to move forward on this one issue, which is to say we want the officers to be thinking about what's right in terms of protecting the public and what's right in terms of apprehending somebody and balancing that out and thinking about the safety of the situation, but not opening themselves up to civil liability as a result of the acts of somebody else, not their own acts. Thank you.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it clear in other statute that the person being pursued is responsible for any problems?
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat that question?
The person being pursued, he made a statement that they should be responsible rather than police. Is that clear?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, if they're the, in terms of tort law, if they're the proximate cause of an accident or an injury, yes, they would be held legally responsible.
Okay, so that's not confusing to me.
Correct.
Okay. Are we in work session?
Hang on a second. Council, did you have any comments?
I was just going to say there'd be joint and several liability, and my assumption is that the reason the police agencies are always pulled into this is because the people that are being pursued probably have no insurance and no funds. So just as a practical matter, I think that's where it stands presently.
Why don't you explain the concept of joint and several liability? Some members may be familiar with that.
Where there are multiple parties that may be responsible for the same act or omission that gives rise to the liability, multiple parties may be what's called jointly and severally liable. That means they may individually be susceptible to suit, and it does not, the law does not require you to bring suit against each of those people. As a practical matter, a good lawyer will sue everyone in sight because you don't want the finger being pointed at the empty chair. But practically, a large judgment or perhaps even a small judgment against a deadbeat is a deadbeat judgment.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, well, I'm certainly in sympathy with what this bill is trying to do, but I'm concerned that there doesn't seem to be any connection between the existence of a policy and actually complying or following that policy. In other words, if there's a policy on file, there's an event that takes place, there doesn't seem to be any connection. And I'm particularly concerned by having the criteria for the policy deleted. I can understand the rationale for doing that, but if you eliminate the criteria and you assign immunity, then I'm concerned that really substandard criteria could provide immunity that may not be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I'm sensitive to that point. What I was proposing to do with the changes was to remove some lawyers' hooks. Because if you include these requirements in this legislation, lawyers will be able to bring an action and say, aha, but this pursuit didn't meet the policy, or the policy didn't meet the statutory standard. In other words, points of argument where they then get to keep the case going anyway, saying, well, you didn't quite meet the statutory standard, or again, the officer exercised discretion in violation of the policy, and then they get back into the whole policy issue. It could be possible to address the issue by having a separate statute, which would fit into this bill, that says here are the standards that you are supposed to follow in establishing a written policy. Go ahead and delineate the standards.
But whether or not those standards were followed and whether or not those standards are adequate is not a basis for attacking someone in the pursuit case. That is, you separate the two, and you don't allow one to serve as the basis for the lawsuit. You could still require the written policy. You could require the standards, but say that's not going to be the basis for the cause of action. You know, we may go after you budgetarily. We may impose other sanctions on you. There could be discipline imposed on an officer, but make that a separate issue, but get back to saying if there is a written policy and it's available for public inspection, then that is it. The pursuing officer and the agency shouldn't be held liable for what happens in that pursuit in terms of what the perpetrator has done.
Maybe then, I hear what you're saying on that, the concerns about that, but maybe if you then said, had some kind of, you know, the comparable thing would be arbitrary and capricious, some kind of threshold there for blatant violations of the policy, without any connection at all, it would really be the same as granting blanket immunity. That's what my concern is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I was also asked about that earlier today, and one of the things that's happened, unfortunately, in government over the years is that as we created all these procedures and standards to allow government to be sued, because constitutionally the government could say, you can't sue us, that's it. But as we've allowed this to happen, we've thought more and more like lawyers rather than applying fairness and common sense. For example, there's nothing that would prevent a unit of local government from deciding, in this case, this officer was out of line, and even though we can't be sued, we're going to pay for someone's injuries or we're going to pay for damages to property. We don't see that happen as much anymore as it used to before the state and local governments dropped their tort immunity and allowed themselves, well, the state actually did it, for everybody saying, well, you can be sued for this amount. I'd suggest that if there is a policy in place that says you've got immunity if you have the written pursuit policy, it is also possible for a unit of government to decide, in this case, we're going to pay the damages or we're going to pay medical bills because it's the right thing to do, not because we're obligated to do so. And more important in terms of enforcement, disciplinary action can be taken against an officer who violates that policy. And that can be the enforcement technique to make sure the policy is followed.
Senator Lester.
Yeah, just follow up on that, Kevin. I'm having problems with that, too, is the immunity subject to adopting a policy and having it available for public inspection. But to say we have a policy, even though there's no requirement that they have complied with the policy. We have a policy, yes, and they totally violated it, but you have immunity because we have a policy. I mean, you think that the logical assumption would be we have a policy and it was complied with, not just that we have a policy. Help me with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, well, you're bringing up a very legitimate point, and it's a question of how far, where you want to go on the gradation scale. You could start at the very top and say, hey, no lawsuits at all in these situations, period. You can go to the other end and say, it's pretty much free play. You can do anything you want. People can bring lawsuits under the Tort Claims Act and do what you want. Those are the two extremes. This bill in the amended version tends towards, well, let's say there should be a written policy, and if it's on file available to the public, then you will not have these lawsuits. In response to Senator Burdick's question, I said you could also say separately, although it's not actionable, here's what the written policy has to have in it so that you've got an implementation phase for the written policy that needs to be there, but don't let that become a hook. You can blend with this, frankly, any way you want to through those steps. My preference, and it's just from having dealt with law enforcement over a long time, is to be able to say to the officer, forget liability issues. Go out, be aware of the policy, be a trained professional, and as you're dealing with pursuit decisions, worry about getting the perpetrator versus public safety, balancing those. The policies are supposed to do that. Think what's best for the public generally. But don't be thinking, well, I'm not going to pursue this perpetrator that I think ought to be pursued because I don't want to be sued if something goes wrong. That's the concern that I have. I want to try to get out of the lawsuit situation. You can tighten down the opportunities for lawsuits, and that's what this bill tends to do. You can back off a bit from that and still have good legislation. So I'm allowing for the fact that where you want to be on that meter.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's continue with the testimony, and then we can...
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion. I'm sorry, Senator.
Yeah, I guess my concern always is at what point are you dealing with the legal issue, and at what point are you micromanaging?
All right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, that's a very legitimate point. I think the communities that are subject to these lawsuits would like the legislature to micromanage a little bit to give them a little relief from the threat of legal action. But they have to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Glenn Chastain. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
This is what we're working on. Is that correct?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police, assigned out of our Patrol Services Division. I am here today in support of the general concept of Senate Bill 163. The Oregon State Police agrees with the concept of having a comprehensive pursuit policy in place for the protection of the officers, the public, and for property. We do at this time currently have a policy that governs our pursuits. However, Oregon revised statute should not force specific language that needs to be in place in a police pursuit policy. The statute should only require that the policy be in place in order to grant immunity under this bill. We support the concept of allowing each agency to draft their own policy that conforms with their own individual agency needs. Each pursuit is very unique in itself. Pursuits cannot be governed in general by a rigid rule or statute. In most instances, latitude must be given to the judgment of the officer on the scene. To give some perspective on this issue, on claims against the Oregon State Police, since 1995, July 1, there has been 14 pursuit incidents where a person has brought a claim against the Oregon State Police. In Section 4 of the bill, as Mr. Mannix has said, it requires the Oregon State Police to create a vehicle pursuit report and track all vehicle pursuits from all law enforcement agencies in the state. And that law enforcement unit or law enforcement agency is defined under ORS 181-610. At this time, we do not see a current need to track all the pursuits for all agencies in the state. And I'd be happy at this time to answer any questions.
All right. Russ, are you here? You didn't sign up, but you just kind of showed up.
I did, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the sheriffs. And my apologies. I was in another meeting and got here a little bit late. Basically, I'm echoing the comments of Sergeant Chastain. The Sheriff's Association is in support of the concept of the liability immunity. We would be hesitant to seek a blanket statewide standard for pursuits. We believe that individual communities and jurisdictions ought to set the standard of enforcement that the community is in favor of, rather than an overall blanket policy there. And also, in terms of the data and the tracking, while it would probably be interesting to look at that data, just this morning and throughout this week, the Oregon State Police budget has been down in Ways and Means, and we're looking at an agency that is in a very dire budget circumstance right now, and we feel that the use of resources for the state police would probably be better directed in other areas at this time. Perhaps in the future, when resources are more available, it might be a more worthy and worthwhile thing to do. So, again, I'm here in support of this. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Cortman.
Yes, thank you. First of all, let me say I could not be a law enforcement official. I'm thankful that you, Sergeant, and the Chair can, because I'd hate to think my life would be if there weren't people to protect me. But I'm reminded of the concealed weapons permit issue in this building years ago. And we allowed each county to decide how concealed weapons permits would be handed out. And we decided in a major piece of legislation, I believe it was the 89th session, Chair, that we would standardize that because, well, I won't go into it because you mentioned guns around here and everybody either goes for their guns or they die from it. But I remember the battle very well. We really did think that we should have some standards, just standards out there, because we have 5,000 gun permits in his county with only two people in it, and you only had two gun concealed weapons permits available in Multnomah County, and I remember this in particular. I just have no feel for what this written policy looks like, and I'm nervous right now saying, just say as long as it's a policy in writing, we are not liable, as opposed, and let each city, each county, state police
you know, go their own way. I don't know why, and maybe it is, maybe I'll be all right if at least, is there every single city now have one, every county have one, state police have one, what's in it, how do they vary, why is it, and I assume the chase, and I can't believe what it must be like in these cars sometimes when all heck breaking loose. I mean, I bet it's just wild out there, cars going in all different directions, the weather, the time of day. I'm just struggling here now, Mr. Chair, that I need to have some feel for why we shouldn't have some kind of standards out there versus, no, Peter, you're not a cop. You've never been in a chase. You don't understand. Let the city of Portland do it. Let the city of Salem do it. Let the state police do it. So can you – I just need something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, yes, state police does have one in place, and if you'd like, I can get you a copy of our current policy so you can look at that. And the reason for the flexibility is – in a pursuit, like I said, they're all very unique, and if specific black and white language is placed in policy, it places the officer then that is on scene in this pursuit under constraints where they, at that point, they believe the pursuit may need to continue to take place, but violation of direct policy on this may cause that person to hesitate or do things that they don't feel is necessary at that time to do. And also, from agency to agency, their pursuit may be a different situation in a city of Salem or Portland versus a pursuit that has interstate and state route applicability that's a little different than city street policy. Some of the points in here, matter of fact, I believe all of the pieces that were in the original bill are in our current policy.
Mr. Russ, do you want to take a stab at it?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, again, Russ Spencer for the sheriffs. It is my understanding that every police agency in Oregon does have a pursuit policy, and those policies do vary. And that may depend upon what risk factors that these agencies want to adopt. For example, there are some agencies who say that they the highest percentage of pursuits that we see are often stolen cars. And there are some agencies who say, we're simply not going to place the public and our officers and other property and people in jeopardy simply to recover a stolen car. There are other agencies that say that we're going to have an absolute line here, that we're not going to allow you to run from the police and get away with it unless there's a significantly high risk of personal injury and damage. So, again, it's allowing the communities and the agencies that are answerable to those communities to set the standard and level of enforcement that they're most comfortable with.
Senator Duncan,
Mr. Chair, I was just quickly glancing at the original paragraph 2, the concern Senator Courtney had too. I can understand giving guidelines of things that need to be addressed, but not dealing with how you, not filling that in. I think that's the local control issue and avoids micromanaging. I think it's all right to say that there would be a requirement dealing with the relationship between the officer and supervisor. If we just said that, then you folks decide what fits into that. At least you would consider it and have it in your plan. And a second, you know, procedure. But what the procedure is, that's something you'd have in your plan. All we'd be calling for is a procedure. And so if they addressed Senator Courtney, I don't know, would that do it if we just put the guidelines of things that they need to address but not say what should be in that particular area?
Senator Courtney?
Thank you. I'm sorry, Senator Duncan, I was somewhat talking to Senator Manchin talking, but I'm not in – this is one of those deals where we're sitting in a committee and we're trying to live the life of it, and it's impossible.
Right.
But Section 4 of the original bill, in effect, is that – are you saying to me, Sergeant, are you saying, Russ, you don't like Section 4 of the original? Because you don't like that at all.
Mr. Chairman, Russ Spencer, Senator Courtney, correct. We don't like it.
Let's just say that this is a work in progress. And we'll have to talk about it later. I'm actually thinking that perhaps, and just throw this out, maybe the Department of Public Safety and Standards Training should develop at least minimal standards for what should be contained in a pursuit policy, and then allow the agencies to be more restrictive or less restrictive than that at some point. But I think that the issue of just simply filing a piece of paper and saying, this is our pursuit policy, go get them,
exclamation point, and suddenly you're immune, that doesn't set well. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, I know that most agencies have a very comprehensive policies, they're very strict about it, and they're very concerned about the liability that arises out of it. But if you did pass a blanket immunity, literally you could type up on one piece of paper, this is our pursuit policy, put it in a file drawer, suddenly all of your officers are immune by state law. So that, and that sets up a whole different dynamic. I don't think we want to
Let me ask this question, Senator Menace. Help me. Marin County Sheriff goes into the city of Salem. Can they do that? Can they pursue somebody? All right.
Yes.
Somebody, a city of Salem police officer gets in a chase. Can they pursue them out beyond the city limits? Okay. State police. Can they go anywhere and everywhere? Okay. Here we have a city of Salem procedure. We have a Marin County procedure, state police. Now, let's just assume. Now, look, I'm not trying to tell you your worth. You're the almighty. You're the great one. But can you see here? Oh, wait a minute. Here you are flying around. I mean, oh, well, if you're going to have a computer start speaking to you, you are now leaving the city of Salem limits. Be aware that guideline. You talk about problems, and you're in a state trooper. You can go from your policy. You've got Marion County. But I'm going to tell you something. You're going to need counseling. You're going to be traumatized by just trying to remember the policies, going 90 miles an hour following some drug crack maniac who's banging off cars and a helicopter over the top. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration. I don't know.
I watched that same show.
Well, all right, look, if this is foolish, I'll admit it to you. But I am just trying to deal with what I perceive. I'm not trying to harass you, Sergeant, because you'll ticket me otherwise, and I don't need that. I am trying to figure out why I am struggling with this.
Right.
I mean, I know I got troubles, but I don't understand.
Before let's bring on the remaining witnesses.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Their testimony out of the way. And then we'll start balancing this thing out.
If I could offer just one final comment,
sure.
Mr. Chair. I flipped a coin with Kevin Campbell from the Association of Chiefs of Police, and I lost, so I'm here, and he's back at the other meeting. But the Association of Chiefs of Police do have a model pursuit policy, which they make available to all of their members, and it's essentially, it's a floor, and you can add to it above that, and that might be something that you could consider either through DPSST or some other manner where you say it's, you know, at least this, and it may be more.
All right. Good. Thank you. Good suggestion.
And Chair, I have a copy of that policy. If anybody's interested in taking a look at it, I can make that available.
Why don't we go ahead and get staff to get it? Can we get, you have that right there?
Yeah.
That's a little tiny print, though. Marilyn, I hope you follow it.
You have to have my focus on as you drive.
Bob Gross, you want to come on up? And Mark Landauer. Okay. Yeah, can we get copies of that? You want to know, guys, been in chases? This guy right here, Jason.
Don't dime me up, John.
I think I've been in a few with you, if I'm not mistaken.
Good afternoon, Chair Ennis, members of the committee. We've just passed out a copy of the City of Portland's Police Bureau's General Order on Police Pursuits, so you'll have a copy in your hands in just a moment. It's fairly comprehensive. If you take a glance at it, I think that'll be informative to you. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 163. We think it's long overdue. As a matter of fact, one of the pieces of testimony that I've provided to you is by our Deputy City Attorney David Lesh, who just completed a trial on this very subject that he took about a year and a half to complete. It was terribly expensive for the city. We ultimately prevailed in this particular suit that was a result of somebody who was pursued by the police, struck and killed one individual, injured another individual. Because the pursuee, as your committee counsel had mentioned, was essentially penniless, the individuals went after the city. It was expensive. Again, and it took a great deal of man hours to complete that trial. In any event, we are here in support of the bill as proposed. We believe that our general order would meet the current requirements in sections 2A, B, C, and D, but we certainly understand that other jurisdictions may like flexibility in creating their own pursuit policies, and if the we'd certainly be supportive of some flexibility contained there. I've asked Bob Gross with the Portland's Auto Theft Task Force to appear before you today to answer any questions and testify before you if you have unique questions on pursuits, because his bureau or department within the Bureau, is in pursuits nearly on a daily basis. So thank you.
Bob? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Bob Gross. I'm a sergeant with the Portland Police Bureau. I've been a police officer for nearly 29 years. I've probably been involved in one aspect or another, either participating in or supervising probably 200 pursuits in my career, maybe more. I know exactly what happens in a pursuit, and I know the outcome because I've been on the outcome end of a tragedy back in 1997. Two people were killed at the end of one of my pursuits. I was also involved in the incident that Mark was just talking about. One of my officers was involved in a pursuit of a stolen vehicle. They tried to box the vehicle in. The boxing didn't work. The suspect rammed the police cars and took off at a high rate of speed, turned his lights out. It was like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and continued up Belmont Street in Portland at over 100 miles an hour. The officers terminated the pursuit because it was getting too dangerous. The suspect continued on and crashed into a civilian vehicle at 34 in Belmont, killing the driver and injuring the passenger very severely. The suspect walked away from the accident after he rolled his vehicle probably a half a block. I know what it's like to be in a pursuit. I also know what it's like for the officers who are involved in the pursuits. The officer that was involved in that latest incident is just like you and me, a young man, 26 years old, been an explorer, scout, cadet. All he wanted ever to do was to be a police officer. And when he became involved in that incident, working for me, it nearly ruined his career. He broke down in tears. It's not an easy thing to become involved in one of those, and it's not an easy thing to then, a year and a half later, go through the court process, because the person you were pursuing is now in prison. He doesn't have a dime to his name. He was convicted of manslaughter, and he'll be out of prison probably in 3 or 4 years after he killed a person. And then this officer has to go through a civil trial for a week in front of a jury of his peers to decide whether or not he did the right thing at that moment when he was pursuing and trying to do his job and catching a dangerous felon who was trying to get away from the police. I'm just basically here to give our side of the story. I think this is a real good bill. There's a couple of quirks in it that could probably use a little firming up, but for the most part, police officers are men and women who go out and do the job every day to protect the people in this state and every state in the union. They need a little support, and if they could go out with a clear conscience that if they were doing their job as they're expected to do, and I mean this policy, Police Bureau policy in Portland is very strict, very stringent. I mean, if they could go out and be aware that if they have to live up to this policy, then I don't think they need to deal with the liability issues of being sued after they're trying to do their job. And I'd be free to answer any of your questions if you'd like. Questions, anyone? Anybody?
So I gather from your comments that you, if it can be structured right, you would not object to making some kind of connection between the policy and the observance of the policy.
Senator Burdick, there was a couple of things in the bill that were crossed off there, and I'm comfortable with a strict pursuit policy. I mean, there's some stuff here, requirement that the pursuit be conducted under the direction of the supervisor if a supervisor is available. I mean, Portland Police Bureau policy basically states, I mean, it's very, very explicit as to what we can get involved in and whatnot. I will not allow our pursuit to go on for traffic violations, even though we know that the majority of times the reason a person is running is not because of traffic violations, afraid to get a ticket. It's usually because they've done something else. They've either got warrants outstanding, they just committed a crime. They could be the murderer who is wanted out of Canada. Who knows why they're running. But I will not allow a pursuit to go on for something like a traffic infraction, simply because it states in the general order, you got to take all these different things into account. Are there pedestrians on the street? Are we in a school zone? What's the traffic light? Is it raining? what are the lake conditions? What are the speeds? Is this guy driving stupid? I mean, and the officer is obligated to communicate those particular facts to the supervisor. And if the supervisor isn't hearing what he wants to hear, then he'll terminate the pursuit. And the majority of the officers now are young, they're energetic, and sometimes they don't have, you know, the wherewithal to get all this stuff down right. But hopefully you've got a supervisor out there who's monitoring this pursuit, and every other officer who's becoming involved in the pursuit as well. They have the right to terminate that pursuit if it starts to get too hairy. And I've terminated probably 6, 8, 10 in the last couple of years simply because I didn't like what was going on, and the charges weren't enough to justify the outcome of what might happen. And quite frankly, when I was younger, I worked the night shift. Most of my pursuits happened between 2:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. There's hardly any traffic on the road, but it's still a dangerous time of the day to try and to do any kind of high-speed driving, especially when you're in Portland. But I would not allow that type of stuff. Now, the pursuits during the daytime are extremely hazardous, and you have to have some sort of policy to make sure that officers don't ever step their bounds. And if they do, then there's a process for taking care of that within the general orders.
Senator.
Mr. I'm just curious, with the Portland Police Department here large enough, is an officer on patrol always able to be in contact with a supervisor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, yes, sir. Supervisors, any shift, we've got 5 precincts in the city, and we probably each precinct fields uniform officers, up to 20 officers in each precinct, maybe more depending on the size of the precinct, should have at least 2 supervisors working on that particular shift, on that 8-hour shift. And then that shift will go off duty, then another shift will come on, and you're going to have at least 2 supervisors, including all the other specialty units that are out roaming around doing other stuff. So you've got lots of supervisors out there monitoring what the officers are doing. And the supervisor is directly responsible for the officers on the street.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could pursue, using I believe Senator Courtney's example a while ago, a state police officer or Multnomah County Sheriff traveling through the city, who has the responsibility if you're the supervisor out there? Are they in contact with you, or are they in contact with their headquarters and not with you? Where do you come into play?
In 1995, Portland Police Bureau adopted a pursuit policy, which is a pursuit agreement with the outlying agencies around the city of Portland, Multnomah County, Clark County, Vancouver, Tigard, Washington County, Beaverton, any Hillsborough, all of the agencies surrounding us. And what we have done is if a pursuit starts in Portland, then it's our initial responsibility. The supervisor who is in charge of the officer who is in the pursuit will then monitor that pursuit. If it starts heading out of town, it is the responsibility of the supervisor to then contact outlying agencies wherever it's going. If it's going into Washington County, it's going into Clackamas County, then he lets BOEC, which is the Bureau of Emergency Communications, which is our radio system, know that the pursuit is heading their direction. It is then up to that particular agency to pick up on the coming pursuit. And once that pursuit enters another agency, whether it be Multnomah County or if it's on an interstate, like on then the state police, if they're set up on the freeway to take it, as soon as it leaves Portland, we will hand it off to them. And the first 30 seconds to a minute of a pursuit are the most confusing time of all. The officer, the adrenaline rush, it's enormous. I mean, it's hard to even talk sometimes when you're trying to get the car turned around, you're trying to get your facts about you, you're trying to tell radio what the heck is going on, and you're trying not to run over people while you're trying to stay focused on the suspect who's trying to elude you. After that, things calm down, and it gives you a little bit of time, your mind and your training starts to kick in, and you start figuring out what's going on. And once that happens, then things start to happen pretty calmly. The supervisor can then start taking charge of the pursuit. He's asking for what's going on. How fast is it? What's the traffic like? What's the suspect doing? And then he can then call ahead and get the other agencies involved in this thing if it starts going out of town. Once it leaves our jurisdiction, if the receiving agency is now ready to take over that pursuit, once they've got a car or two to be able to take it, we shut it down and we back off. By our policy, only 3 vehicles are to be directly involved in a pursuit. two directly, one to hang back and support. Any more than that, and you've just got a trail of cop cars going everywhere. If you watch the LAPD, you know, some of the stuff you see down in California, you've got 15 cars. Well, that used to happen in Portland many years ago, and it still happens sometimes throughout the state. But simply because the pursuit goes on for an hour, especially out on the interstates and maybe on some of the rural roads, you're trying to get several different agencies involved, and sometimes the communication isn't as good out there. But if the PDs would develop some sort of interagency cooperative policy, then I think a lot of that could be taken care of, which is what we did back in 95.
Okay, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair. Sergeant Rivers, I need to ask you this because from your testimony, I get the feeling that you're an all-pro chaser.
And, I've done my share.
You know, you may be the best chaser in all of Oregon. You said to over 200. I just can't imagine even, you know. I'm going to read from this. We got this document given to us by the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm not trying to set you up. In number 11, it says, now, this is the way I've seen it on television. You're going to love this.
Mm-hmm.
When in pursuit of a fleeing suspect, you're supposed to stay, should not attempt to overtake or pass. The pursuing officer should keep a safe distance from the suspect and merely attempt to keep the suspect vehicle in sight until the suspect voluntarily stops. Now, I got to tell you, I'm just going to, in all the police chases I've seen on the TV, the sitcoms, I find it interesting, voluntary stops. I don't call it voluntary when they come to a stop. You understand? But that's okay. These are models. The exception to this directive would be during the use of PIT, which is a precision intervention technique. If appropriate, a precision intervention technique maneuver may be executed to terminate the pursuit. I got to know, what's a PIT?
Do you know what a PIT is?
Hmm? Okay.
Can you do one?
I can do one.
Okay. I want to know. I mean, I'm not trying to make, I got to know what a PIT is. That's the kind of thing that really got me going. Voluntary stopping, not going to happen. PIT.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, a PIT is what we call a pursuit intervention technique.
I just read that. You're right.
And basically what it entails is an officer driving a marked, fully equipped police car in pursuit of a suspect. If this is according to Portland Police Bureau policy. Other departments do teach the PIT, but they have different ways of as far as maybe how they want it done. Our policy states that if the speed is below 35 miles an hour, and the officer has an opportunity and a clear field of range here on a straight stretch or on a corner where there's no other traffic, the officer moves up to either side of the rear of the vehicle and uses the front portion of either his front or like the right or left front of his vehicle, and he will make contact with the rear portion of the suspect vehicle, give a little gas, a little tap on the wheel, and it just pushes him just enough to break the back end of the car loose and pushes through them, and the vehicle will do a 180-degree spin, the suspect vehicle will, and on the majority of times it will stall the engine and it will come to stop on the other side of the street facing the other way. I sense we're going to have a demonstration of this.
All right.
It works.
Yeah, your policy says, I got to ask, 35.
35 and under.
Are there other policies out there that talk about how fast you're permitted to go, you're going before you make this move, or you don't go more than this?
I'm sure that they do. The majority of the training that has been taught in Oregon came out of California, the Highway Patrol. That's where our guys got their training in the training division, and they came back and taught us. And the overall standard is 35 and under. Now,
over that is allowed to be used.
Anything over that is considered deadly force.
Deadly force, no deadly force.
Oh, you know all about the pit?
You bet I do.
So, but my point is, okay, you're telling me you don't pit in the state of Oregon. No pits, state, city, county, unless you're 35 and under.
I'm saying in Portland, that is the policy.
Well,
what? There's no statewide.
See?
No
statewide. There's something going on at 35 that only you know and only Dennis know. You know something about 35.
If you get over that,
you would never want me pitting.
Well, you've got to be trained to do it.
Well,
the problem is when you get over speeds of 35, it's sheer physics of the vehicle and the inertia of the vehicle moving as fast as it causes it to roll or move into a motion that is uncontrollable as a way towards under 35.
We do have other techniques. I mean, there's lots of ways.
The only point I was trying to make is I stumbled. First of all, I really wanted to know about this.
Sure.
Because I'm going to use it in the speech now. I really feel like I can do something. I'm not going to go pitting anybody
Can we take out heavy?
No, I don't want to do that.
You'll
the
like
point
it.
Is,
you'll want to do it on the freeway.
You know,
I want to go hear your speech.
You know, I wonder if your view of the PIP is the view you exercise in terms of all PIPs. And I don't think you, and that's all I'm asking. And you don't answer that question, sorry.
Okay, because it's not a fair question to anybody.
It's just a little thing I wanted to know about.
Right. Chairman, I'm really disappointed in my ride-along now that I know that I've never had to do a PIP.
Yeah. What's a ride-along if you don't PIP?
All I get to do is a J-turn.
Well, we can see if we can arrange some pitting practice. Bob, thank you very much. Mark, thank you. And we're going to close the public hearing on this. And I think what we'll do is try to put together a bit of a work on the structure of the bill so that it hopefully meets the committee's approval. And Russ, would you be interested in helping? And Mark, would you? Okay, good. All right, so we'll put together a work group, bring it back with some amendments, and hopefully be able to talk about it and see if we can move to something that makes everybody happy. Hearing, and now we're going to go into Representative Lane Shetterly is here to grace us with his presence from the House Revenue Committee. 2425, public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is my first chance to be in front of you this session. I'm glad to be here. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. Are you opening this just for my testimony, or will you be taking other testimony at this
other
point? In that case, I'd invite Dave Hendricks and Brad. Are you on this, too?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since this is your first opportunity to have an Oregon Law Commission bill in front of you, I thought I would briefly share just a little bit about the background of the Law Commission. We created it in 1997 to serve as a body that includes legislators and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the Attorney General, the deans of the three law schools in the state, and a governor appointee, and four members appointed by the Oregon State Bar Association to serve as a body involved in continuous program of law improvement. And we have 10 bills before the 2001 legislative session. I'm pleased to say that six of those bills are already now from the House to the Senate side, and this bill, 2425, is the first Law Commission bill to make it to the Senate Judiciary Committee. This bill comes as the product of a work group that began work in March of 1999 and concluded in December of 2000. It was broadly representative of members of the Bar, the Courts, Law Commission, and Department of Justice, dealing with an issue that is not probably as exciting as pits and car chases. You liked that, didn't you? You did. But a problematic aspect of Oregon law in the statutes. Back around the turn of the century, you had a fairly narrow universe of terms that applied to public entities. You had state and you had county and city and town and those kinds of things. And the number of terms in the statutes was fairly small. Over the course of the past 100 years, we as legislators and our predecessors have dreamed up more ways than you can imagine to refer to various types of public entities. And I'll just refer to some of those that appear in this very entertaining Law Review article. So if you have some time, it's actually worth looking at. I think you have it in your materials as it goes through some of the terms that are used. We have quasi-municipal corporation, independent public corporation, political subdivision of the state, intergovernmental authority, political subdivision, civil subdivision, quasi-political subdivision, and it gets more obtuse and arcane as you go beyond that. What's the problem with that? Well, the problem is this. You have a number of laws that relate to public bodies. You have the public contracting statutes, you have the public records laws, you have the public meetings laws, you have public budget and other finance laws. That relate to public bodies or maybe some public bodies, but it is not clear in the statute how these terms all relate to each other. And so we have a bill before you that doesn't fix any of these existing ambiguities because there are just too many terms to go back and try to amend, too many statutes to try to amend. But this bill that's before you today, House Bill 2425, will serve as a reference point henceforth for legislators and for drafters as they draft statutes that relate to public bodies. It will say, tell us what you mean. What kind of public body is it? And it will help guide drafters and legislators and policymakers and then the public to a better understanding of what we are referring to when we refer to various types of public bodies in the statute. It's a small bill in terms of what it does, but it will serve a purpose as we go forward from here. I will tell you, I've already seen some bills come through that could stand to be amended to reflect the drafting in this bill, where we've already imposed obligations or made references in statutes to public bodies or public entities, and already this session we are creating new anomalous kind of entities or bills about which we are not being very clear. This bill will help focus legislative council and help focus legislators in the future as we develop legislation to determine what we mean and be clear about it when we refer to various types of public bodies. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will be happy to answer any questions, and if there are none, I will excuse myself to finish off my revenue committee. It's one of those days.
Representative, do you want to testify on the other bill?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
2410.
Yeah.
You know, Mr. Chair, could I ask you a quick question?
Absolutely.
On the original bill here, did you... You're just defining public bodies. You're not trying to straighten out. For example, we use the term county commission. We use the term county court. Those are interchangeable in certain counties and so forth. You didn't deal with that kind of
thing. No, you know, Senator Duncan, there was, I think, at least one or two efforts. I wouldn't say so much effort. I think it was considered once or twice about going back and taking a look at all of these statutes that refer to these various types, refer to to public bodies by various nomenclature, and it was just, it was incomprehensible to begin to do that, because frankly it got you into some problematic policy decisions. You know, do you mean to apply the public meetings law to this entity or not? Well, it's hard to say after the fact what the legislature might have meant when you created these, when previous legislators created these entities. So rather than try to go back and fix these questions that exist now in the statute, we thought we'd leave things as they are and make this a prospective fix so that from here on out in drafting we can be clear.
Mr. Chair, does that mean that you think at some time that needs to be addressed and you just didn't address it, or is that something you think does not need to be addressed?
I think it will be addressed in this way. As those existing statutes are amended in the future and as they come up before legislative council, this will probably become a fairly regular amendment that we will see going forward now dealing with these existing statutes as they are amended.
Okay, that makes sense. Representative, if you want to go ahead and testify on is it 2410?
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing. Close to the public hearing on, what is it, 2425, and open a public hearing on 2410. Then we'll go back and pick up Mr. Hendricks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shatterly, State Representative, District 34, testifying in favor of House Bill 2410, which I introduced at the request of the Polk County Victim Offender Reconciliation Program. It's a program of which my wife was the president for probably 15 years or so, and so I'm pleased to be associated with it. And with this bill, we have an existing statute, ORS 36.210, that is amended by this, that creates a level of civil immunity for mediators, mediation programs, and dispute resolution programs that provide mediation and dispute resolution program services. This bill extends the immunity to other types of dispute resolution services, because since this bill, since the existing statute was enacted, you've had quite a development in that level of dispute resolution services, and you now have things such as community mediation programs, and in Polk County, the Victim Offender Reconciliation Program, which technically is not perhaps a mediation program as it would be construed under this statute. And so we are broadening the scope to include other types of dispute resolution services, and we are filling a gap that I think was probably unintentionally left in the original statute, and that is to extend that limitation on liability not only to the mediators and the programs, but also to the directors and officers of those programs. These almost invariably around the state are volunteer organizations, and given the nature of the activities with which they are involved, it is not uncommon for someone who is asked to serve on a volunteer basis on one of these boards to inquire about their civil liability in the event that there's a problem in the event, the way the mediation or dispute resolution service is provided. This extends that limitation on liability to the directors and officers and a broader group of agents of these programs. I will say that it passed out unanimously out of the House Judiciary Committee, and I believe it was unanimously approved on the House floor as well. And I'll open myself to questions on that.
Hey, hang on. Okay, thank you. Any questions at all? Anybody? Who's Sandy Peterson?
Patterson.
That's what Patterson. Did you have anything in addition to the two other names?
I'm just not sure. I'm Patterson. I'm the director of the Director of Community Mediation.
All right. Thank you very much. Work session 2410. Senator Burdick.
House Bill 2410 to the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2410 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Senator Burdick, carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2425. Dave.
Chairman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm not going to say a whole lot about 2425. Our office obviously has an interest in this, since this is a tool that we anticipate that we will be using should it become law. Representative Sherley's already talked about the huge number of different terms that have crept into the law to talk about different sorts of public bodies. And it is a problem, has been a problem in some cases that have come up where there has been some litigation because of laws that have talked about public bodies or have used old terminology talking about municipal corporations or public corporations in a sense that are different than what they now have. And it has always been troublesome for me as a drafter when someone has come in with a request and they said, well, make it not, say that it's not applicable to public bodies, that we don't have really some very good set of definitions as to what that is. And when I ran the computer checks on it, for instance, we've got like 120 statutes that talk about public bodies without any definition at all, as though everybody in the world knew what that meant. And the fact of the matter is, after long struggles in a work group trying to define it, we found that it's not an easy thing to define what a public body is. This effort was a consensus project that the Judicial Department and the Department of Justice were, of course, very interested in how this turned out, since representing the two other branches, that they're concerned about laws that talk about public bodies and how it's going to talk about them and whether they're included and whether they're not. There are many, many statutes that are unclear on that point, whether or not, for instance, the Judicial Department is covered by a given law. The nice thing about the bill as it now stands is that as we go forward and we start revising laws, we go back and do things like the public contracting project that's going on right now, there'll be an opportunity for the people in the work groups doing those projects to look at these definitions and say, well, is this what we mean when we say a public body for purposes of public contracting? Our work group didn't feel comfortable trying to go back, you know, we just didn't have the level of expertise in those areas to go back and try to figure out what was intended when those laws were passed. We felt it was going to be much more appropriate as other groups who are closer to the individual areas are looking at those laws, that they will have these to look at and say either, yeah, that's exactly what we meant when we said local government, or no, that's not what we mean. When we say local government, we mean to include, for instance, school districts. One of the problems we've got in a lot of laws right now that talk about local governments, it's unclear as to whether or not a school district is a local government. So this particular bill doesn't build a building, doesn't build a house, it doesn't even build a shed.
But it does provide some tools that over time, as we draft new bills, we'll be able, when you get a bill draft back from our office, you'd be able to look at it, and it's going to say, we're talking about state government as defined in ORS 174 blank, blank, blank. And at least at that point, it'll be out on the table for everybody that when we say state government, we mean what this bill says. I'd be happy to talk about the minutia of this thing, but...
Please don't.
Otherwise, I'll just ask if you have any questions about it.
Brett, any issues? Senator Harper.
Do we define arbitrator?
Chairman, Senator Harper, we do not.
Just checking.
Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel with the State Court Administrator's Office, and today, though I am here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission with the permission of the Chief Justice, my boss, the State Court Administrator, I worked on the work group with this bill. We went to the project, and maybe the best way to look at this, because we struggled with it for a long time, is that this is a tool in the toolbox, and you're going to need this tool on the journey that you're about to embark on. And that journey is something that was started by the Oregon Law Commission, and it's something that you'll be dealing with, and it's something the courts deal with in the future. Which laws apply to which public bodies and to which entities? This will give you a tool to deal with that as you address new laws. There has been some discussion in the Oregon Law Commission about bringing in laws in subsequent sessions to clean some of these up as they have an ability to. The bill affects nothing currently other than to give you that tool. I'm here in support of it, and I can answer any questions that you got if you like.
I love this new age language, so let me just do the tool in the toolbox. Okay, that's nice. I think that's nice. What kind of tool? Since you use that, Learned High Counsel, I want you to tell me, what tool is it?
Okay. As you draft new laws.
No, that's not. No. So there you go, counsel. Okay. Hammer, screwdriver, chisel. Just come up with something. What kind of tool? Give me that kind of, because that's what I'm going to do in this, if I carry the bill. That's how, the only way the senator is going to be related to this. You set a tool. Give me some kind of real tool that's on my tool shed. Give me one, please. Quickly, think it up.
Chairman,
It's a Swiss Army knife, Senator.
Excuse me, I am listening to learn it. I asked you a question, counsel. You went and did that. I was taught in law school. You don't do that unless you know what the next thing is coming. I want to know. You said tool. Give me the tool.
Chairman, Senator Courtney, from a legal viewpoint, tool that you've got is an accurate description. More appropriately, something like a Swiss Army knife that you can use for a number of different purposes. But it's an accurate description for which there is no standard description now. There is no definition.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. I appreciate it. All right. Mr. Carnegie, do you want to speak on this or not? Because I want to move the bill.
All right. Oh, excuse me. Hold on.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mr.
As I told Mr. Carnegie when he came talking about this series of bills coming, nothing makes me more nervous than hearing that 100 lawyers worked on something for a year and it's been declared as housekeeping. and there was one thing that I picked up right away on line 17 of this bill, first page, that none of the terms defined in sections 1 to 9 of this 2001 Act includes the Oregon Health Students Science University, and the Oregon State Bar. Why?
Chair Menace, Senator Beyer, currently, under their own enabling statutes, these particular bodies are exempted from laws that are applicable to public bodies, except as they are specifically included. And one of the concerns about this was to not create a term public body that would be used in a manner inconsistently with what the legislature had used it in the past. And it was clear from past legislation that these two particular bodies were excluded except when they were specifically mentioned. And so that's why that was presented that way in the draft.
Mr. Chair, isn't the Oregon State Bar a private organization?
Well, that's interesting. Chair Menace, Senator Beyer, it is a public entity of some type that is defined by its own statutes as to which public laws it is subject to. In its statutes, it's subject to certain public records law, to certain other laws, but it is not subject in general to laws that are applicable to public bodies. And it is some kind of public entity that was created by law, by statute.
Actually, one of the wheels just came off this bill, because the idea of state accident insurance fund, where do they fit in this thing?
Chairman, the state accident insurance fund is declared by statute to be a public corporation and to be a public entity of some sort. So clearly it's a public body underneath the bill. I believe that going through it and based on the definitions we have here, it's probably going to fall, it is going to fall underneath one of the special governmental bodies, because we specifically indicate in section 8, and that's on page 4 at line 16 to 17, that public corporations are special government bodies. I should tell you that the special government body definition is there only for the purposes of fleshing out what is a public body. I don't see anybody ever drafting a law that addresses special government bodies. But on the other hand, they're clearly not in the executive department, they're not in the legislative department, they're not local government. So laws on these things are probably going to have to be drafted. They're going to have to think about whether they want to cover something like SAIF when they draft laws.
So, all right. I think I understand the cause. Any other questions? No? Okay. Anybody ready for a work session?
Work session. Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2425 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. Senate, excuse me, House Bill 2425 to the floor of the Senate, unamended. The due pass recommendation. Senator Byer.
Mr. Chair, not being an attorney, and I see this as being the same as last session when this bill came forward that exempts attorneys from, I don't remember the bill, but I remember I hated it, and it was brought to us by the attorneys, the only attorneys that were in our caucus, and I think it went down in flames on the floor, if I remember right. But I see, you know, so that the attorneys have written themselves out of the bill, and I don't think there was an adequate explanation for why they did it. I'm not going to vote no, but I think it's disturbing to see that everybody else is included in the bill except for the Oregon State Bar, and that really...
And the Oregon Health Sciences University.
Yeah. So.
Although we did hear testimony that they are governed by their own separate sets of statutes, so to that extent, the laws do govern them. But you're right, they are different. They're not included for these...
And their enabling legislation, by statute, it does require that they have to be specifically opted into each individual section. So these kind of blanket definitions wouldn't be the place to, you would override that, you would totally obviate that provision if you were to take them out of the exemption. And they would be pulled into all of the other laws.
Which is what's going to happen to all the rest of these special districts and local governments and everything else, much to their lack of knowledge. They're not going to know when all of a sudden they're pulled into something else because they didn't fit the definition anywhere else. They're going to get pulled in someplace. But the Oregon State Bar specifically make sure they are not. They're looking out for themselves again.
Okay. Trading on thin ice here, aren't I? Because I'm not a member of the bar. I can trash them too, can't I? Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Who wants to carry this puppy?
How about Roger Byer?
I think.
Well, still on for the Robert trip tomorrow?
Yes.
Yes,
by the way,
even though we have caucus.
We have caucus. Thursday caucus. Yeah, we all have caucus.
We are on
what time do we leave?
Noon.
Noon.
Out front on the...
Hey.